You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. We love the earth. It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Tuesday, October 24th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. And boy, has it got to be a special day here on the show. Because I got a copy from one of my listeners, Medicinal Colorado out there, sent me a copy of Ben Cort's new book. Looks kind of cool on the green screen. Weed Inc. Weed Inc. The Truth About THC, the Pot Lobby, and the Commercial Marijuana Industry. This is written by Ben Cort. He's one of the board members from Project Samuel, Smart Approaches to Marijuana Use Except Legalization. And it's chock full of reefer madness. It's amazing how you can fit so much reefer madness into just 250 pages, but it's all in here. The not your father's Woodstock weed, the more dispensaries than Starbucks and McDonald's, the super potent weed of today, all the scares are in here, but something's in here that I didn't expect. Me! I'm in this book, folks! If anything, that's the reason you should go out and buy it, right? I'm in this book. Ben Cort actually talks about a debate that we had 2 years ago at TCU, Texas Christian University, where I mopped the floor with the guy. I'm going to go into that and a few other things that you'll find in this book. It's my latest radical rant. You'll see it up on hightimes.com shortly. But I got to tell you all about the biggest prohibitionist lie. I know the Woodstock weed's a big lie, and it's going to cause a motivational syndrome and lead straight to heroin. They're all big lies, but Ben Cort, on page one, tells you the biggest lie of prohibitionists. I'll tell you what that is at the end of the program. Also on the show today, it's time for our Sensible Future segment, where we focus on Students for Sensible Drug Policy, one of the most effective organizations out there. And we visit with Deputy Director of SSDP and a 2005 alumnus, Stacia Costner. She'll be joining us to talk about the history of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And of course, we start everything off with cannabis headline news. In the news today, we'll give you some information on what's happening internationally in Jamaica. We're always interested in what's going on there. And some compelling news coming from the New York Times regarding some tragic deaths in Honduras that it seems our DEA has been lying about. What? The DEA lies? Who knew? Let's get to it. Here's the news.
This is your cannabis headline news. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Tuesday, October 24th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. On Monday, Maine lawmakers approved a bill that would establish regulations for the legal marijuana market, with the House voting 81 to 50 and the Senate voting 22 to 9 before both chambers passed the measure in an under-the-hammer or unanimous vote. The omnibus bill, LD 1650, was the culmination of nearly 7 months of work by the Marijuana Legalization Implementation Committee. The bill creates the rules for licensing and regulating marijuana producers, processors, and retail establishments, sets the tax rates for adult-use marijuana, and will delay marijuana consumption social clubs until the summer of 2019. Last week, Governor Paul LePage and House Minority Leader Ken Fredette announced legislation that would further delay legal marijuana sales and cultivation until 2019, 3 years after voters approved Question 1, which made marijuana legal for adults and regulated similarly to alcohol. That moratorium bill was defeated in the legislature on Monday. Governor LePage has also threatened to veto the implementation bill. A three-hour video showing a gun battle between DEA and alleged cocaine smugglers shows that the agency lied about how four Honduran civilians were killed. The New York Times acquired the video through a Freedom of Information Act request. The DEA for 5 years has stuck with its story that the gunfire began from a boat that collided with a canoe carrying the DEA agents and Honduran forces. The video, taken with night vision by a surveillance plane, shows instead the flashes of gunfire starting from the canoe. There is no indication that the canoe was fired upon from the boat. As boat passengers leapt into the water, the video shows DEA continuing to fire at them, with a Honduran helicopter adding machine gun fire from above. One man, two women, and a 14-year-old boy were killed in the hail of bullets. This May, an investigation from the inspectors general found no evidence to support the DEA's account of the events in question. Two licenses have just been granted in the Caribbean nation of Jamaica for the production and processing of cannabis into medicinal oil. Jamaica Gleaner reports that Epican Medicinals got the first cultivation license and Everything Oily Labs Limited got the first processing license for medicinal cannabis products on the island. Jamaica's Cannabis Licensing Authority will then take possession of the processed oil. Hyacinth Lightbourne, chairman of the Cannabis Licensing Authority, explained that, quote, one of the requirements as per international regulations is that the CLA has to take custody of all raw products at some point in time, end quote, referring to international treaties that require governments that allow cannabis production to maintain control over the product, such as the United States' only federally legal cannabis farm at the University of Mississippi. Yet another poll is showing that 3 out of 4 residents of Utah support the medical use of cannabis. The new poll by the Salt Lake Tribune and the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics shows that 75% of Utah voters either strongly or somewhat support the proposed initiative for medical marijuana in 2018, all but mirroring a July poll that had 77% of voters backing legalized medical marijuana. The latest poll found that some 93% of the state's Democrats support legalization, compared to a smaller majority of Republicans, 65%, who also back the idea. Filed in June, the ballot initiative would allow consumption of medical marijuana topicals, oils, and edibles for qualifying illnesses such as Alzheimer's disease, cancer, multiple sclerosis, post-traumatic stress, chronic pain, and autism. Smoking marijuana, driving while intoxicated, and all public uses would be prohibited. Eventbrite has become the latest online platform to ban cannabis-related businesses. According to reporting in Forbes, the online event ticketing retailer suddenly dropped ticket sales for the New York Cannabis Film Festival, telling the purveyor, who'd used the service for previous festivals, that he was locked out of his account due to, quote, violations of laws surrounding a federally regulated substance, end quote. Another event, the Southern California Cannabis Business and Investment Group, had its networking events dropped by Eventbrite after using the service for over a year and a half. Eventbrite's spokesperson said, quote, we cannot permit any event where cannabis is included with the purchase of a ticket or consumption is facilitated, end quote. However, several such events still remain on the Eventbrite platform, including 420 Friendly Yoga in Boston and a cannabis happy hour in Washington, D.C., advertising free dabs all night. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Tuesday, October 24th, 2017.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
And now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
McGruff here. If someone asks you to try drugs, think of me and say what I'd say. And to help you, have one of these masks.
Well, thanks, McGruff.
Now, what are you going to say if someone asks you to try drugs?
My mom and dad told me not to, and I wouldn't lie to them.
Sensational.
Don't use drugs.
Here's how you can get a free mask. And on the back are more ways to say no and help me take a bite out of crime.
To combat this sort of reefer madness, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at mjagenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the Alcohol Agenda. But a lot safer.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal potland Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
This is A Sensible Future, brought to you by Students for Sensible Drug Policy at ssdp.org. Drug policy is an issue that primarily affects the young, both in terms of use and legal prosecution. SSDP believes in honest education about drugs and advocates for harm reduction policies to protect young adults and society at large. We speak with another dedicated activist from SSDP, working toward a sensible future.
Welcome to A Sensible Future. We are producing in a partnership with Students for Sensible Drug Policy. I'm Russ Belville. Welcome to the podcast. And joining us for this episode, we have Stacia Costner. She's the Deputy Director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and you can find more at ssdp.org. Stacia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Russ. Thanks for having me.
Students for Sensible Drug Policy is one of my favorite reform organizations because it takes young and idealistic kids. I mean, I'm almost 50, so I can say kids, I suppose, but young adults who are in college and even in some other student situations. Tell folks about SSDP just in general. Who's involved and how can they get involved?
Sure. So Students for Sensible Drug Policy is a grassroots network of students dedicated to ending the war on drugs. We were founded in 1998, and today in 2017, we have presence on about 300 campuses across most U.S. states and in 20 countries abroad.
So is it just at the university or college level, or are there some high school students involved?
It's mostly at the university and college level, but we do have a handful of really awesome rock star high school chapters that are, you know, in my opinion, ahead of their time and that have found us early. So we definitely have a presence on a few high school campuses as well.
How about at the postgrad level, like perhaps law schools or anything like that? Any SSDP chapters there?
Yeah, we've got probably around 10 or a dozen law school chapters. You know, it's a natural fit for people that get into law because they're interested in criminal justice or drug law. So we have a bunch of chapters. Their involvement looks a little bit different than an undergrad chapter, but we definitely have a lot of law schools. We have, I think we have one medical school and a few other grad schools that we're active on as well.
Well, that's fantastic. And to be clear, so everyone understands, of course, this podcast is a part of the Marijuana Agenda podcast, but your mission is broader than just the prohibition of marijuana. Can you explain a little?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the genesis of Students for Sensible Drug Policy was back in 1998. The Higher Education Act aid elimination penalty was introduced. And that meant that any student that was convicted of any drug crime, whether it was a misdemeanor or a felony, whether it happened before they enrolled in college or while they were enrolled in college, would be automatically ineligible for federal financial aid. And so, you know, students of the time saw that as a, you know, really direct affront to students' rights coming from the drug war. So they decided to band together and start to do something about it. Of course, you know, Normal has been around since the 70s, and there were Normal chapters back in the late 90s. But, you know, our founders really wanted to, you know, our core issue and our focus to be a bit wider than just marijuana. They saw, you know, that this would impact people who had other kind of drug charges as well, you know, saw the drug war as a failure as a whole rather than just focusing on one aspect of that, which is, of course, marijuana.
A much broader focus and born out of a particular issue dealing with that Higher Education Act. What are some of the more modern issues that SSDP is having to deal with, especially now that we have the new administration in play?
Yeah, you know, things are definitely still changing at a rapid pace. And, you know, it's not entirely clear to us what our specific targets are going to be yet with this new administration. But of course, there's, you know, just generally the idea that Jeff Sessions is, you know, really committed to a law and order type of approach, a punitive type of approach. We're about, you know, looking at drug use and drug policy through a public health lens and not a criminal justice lens. And it seems that the people who, you know, are at the top of this issue in the federal government, such as Jeff Sessions, you know, really see the way to deal with people using drugs by just locking them up and putting them behind bars. And of course, we don't think that is very effective. You know, that's the approach that has been used since the 70s when Richard Nixon launched the war on drugs. And it, you know, hasn't done much to prevent people from accessing drugs or to prevent the harm caused by drugs or drug prohibition. So we think an alternative approach is probably the better way to go, and just trying to, you know, generally focus public opinion on aligning behind our sort of values on this issue rather than the prohibitionist punitive values.
So SSDP is formed in 1998. You're creeping up on 20 years, two decades almost in drug policy advocacy. Take us through the early years at SSDP. Who was involved, and what were some of the major milestones in the development of the organization?
Sure. So this was even before my time, back in 1996, 1997. Some people might be familiar with the Drug Reform Coordination Network, DRCNet. So DRCNet had an early internet discussion page or forum, you know, with people that were working on drug policy reform. And then Adam Smith, who is one of our early co-founders, noticed that there was a lot of .u email addresses on that list. And he decided that, you know, there are, you know, unique ways students can be organizing around any issue, and especially this issue. So he pulled out all of those EU email addresses and created a separate list for, you know, what they called at the time, the student drug reform movement. So that started in the, you know, late 90s, and then more and more actions started springing up on campuses protesting the Higher Education Act, the elimination penalty. And then this led to our first conference, which was held in Washington, D.C. in, let's see, 1998, it would have been. And the attendees decided to form SSDP into a national organization and elect board of directors that had one representative from each of the five schools that we were active on at the time. And so that those, I think that those five schools were definitely American University, Rochester Institute of Technology, of course, let's see, Hampshire College, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and George Washington University. So that that was sort of the core group that first got us started. And, you know, our early years were really focused on the Higher Education Act elimination penalty. There was, you know, a famous drug warrior in Congress, Mark Stouter, who sort of became our mortal enemy. And, you know, we would go to events that he was at and sort of confront him about this issue and do sort of like on the ground events like that. And then I would say in the mid-2000s or so, a lot of, you know, marijuana law reform opportunities started to spring up. So that became a big focus of ours. And then, you know, of course, through all of the years, generally organizing students, informing them of their rights, raising awareness about failures of the drug war and about ways that, you know, a harm reduction approach could have been taken. And so I would say that that's probably a big change that I've noticed is that, you know, we've moved from, let's see, from focusing on things like financial aid and marijuana law reform to things that are, what's the word I'm looking for, maybe a little bit more progressive, a little bit more radical, things like needle exchange and naloxone, which is an overdose reversal drug, and psychedelics and psychedelic harm reduction and things like that. So it's really interesting. I got involved about 11 years ago when things were really marijuana-centric, and then today things are a lot less marijuana-centric, although, you know, it's the beast that just refuses to die, this marijuana prohibition. So there's, of course, a lot of work still left to do and a lot of interesting opportunities on campuses where, you know, state law, for example, if you're on a campus in California, you know, state law says that it's not a crime to possess marijuana or to use it in the privacy, you know, of your home. But on campus, it's not permitted. So people are still getting in trouble for doing something that is legal in that state. So our students are really exploring, you know, those campus policies and what things are standing in the way there, what, you know, sort of elements the administrations are concerned with, trying to, you know, reset some of their misconceptions about what their policies can and can't do under federal law.
One of the other aspects I really appreciate about Students for Sensible Drug Policy is it's almost like a boot camp, a training ground for the people who become the activists of the future. Give us a few of your alumni stories, some alumni who have moved on to continue in the industry side of things, as well as the advocacy side of things.
Sure. Yeah. I manage our Alumni Association program, and I am so, so proud of so many of our alums working in like really diverse fields, both related to drug policy and marijuana and not at all. But relating to the marijuana industry, I'll start there first. Probably our biggest success story there would be Sean Luce, who is the chief operating officer for Berkeley Patients Group, one of the oldest and largest cannabis dispensaries in California. So he came through SSDP in like 2002 or so, and really was able to take the training, knowledge, and connections that he gained through SSDP and help turn that into a thriving business. On the advocacy side, we have Tom Angel, of course, who runs Marijuana Majority and also produces the Marijuana Moment and writes for Massroots. He, is responsible for culling together all of this, marijuana news developments, which are happening on a daily basis in so many different places, and, pulling that together and drawing our attention to, the most important among them, and, breaking marijuana news stories, and just being a really genius media expert on the issue. And then sort of in between those two, we have Troy Dayton, who's the CEO of the ArcView Group, which is a marijuana investor network. We have people in those types of fields. We have Shalene Keitel, who is the founder of THC Staffing Group, which is, a cannabis industry staffing firm. She also does a lot of other work for, around issues of equality and, racial justice and, things of that nature with her work with the Minority Cannabis Business Association. We've got just a ton of alums all over the country, the world even, doing some really, really interesting work, like really on all aspects of this issue and of the industry.
You've learned a ton about the history of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. I encourage everyone to check out the website at ssdp.org to find the chapter nearest you. And Stacia, like you mentioned, you formed in 1998. That means 2018's coming up. It'll be the 20th anniversary of SSDP. Let's look to the future. What can people expect for 2018 as far as conferences and other events?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as you mentioned, it is our 20th anniversary next year. It's a big deal for us, for sure. So we just announced that our 2018 conference will be March 2nd through the 5th in Baltimore, Maryland. We're going to do a lobby day in conjunction with that. After the weekend of the conference, we'll bus everybody down to Washington, D.C. to meet with their elected officials, about a policy issue that relates to drug policy reform, of course. So that's probably our biggest event. Of course, we'll also have some fundraisers and smaller events throughout the year. We'll be releasing a new website very, very soon, and hopefully some other branding changes like that in the works, and expanding and firming up our presence on our 300 plus campuses across the U.S. and abroad. And I'm excited to see the work that our students are going to do this year and in our 20th year.
I'm looking forward to it as well. Stacia Costner, the deputy director from Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and did you say alumni director? Is that the correct title?
Sure.
Oh, and alumni director, Stacia Costner. Thanks for joining us here on A Sensible Future.
Thank you, Russ.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. If you're a cannabis brand looking to build trust and awareness within the community, consider becoming a sponsor of this program. Your message will be seen and heard by the most dedicated followers of marijuana policy reform, who are loyal and supportive of those brands that give back to the community. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button to learn how your brand can also be featured in my live nationwide appearances. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
buddy, it's Russ Belto from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Just say no.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to leave a state.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
Well, I received from Medicinal Colorado, listeners of mine, a copy of this latest anti-marijuana legalization book from Ben Cort. It's entitled Weed Inc., The Truth About THC, the Pot Lobby, and the Commercial Marijuana Industry. Now, Ben Cort is a board member for Project Samuel, you know, Kevin Sabet's organization, the nation's leading prohibitionist think tank. He also describes himself as a recovering marijuana addict. Yeah, he's been recovering from marijuana for over 20 years now. He was addicted by the age of 17. And so now he's a recovering addict who's going to save the rest of us from the perils of marijuana. Now, in that, I do have to give Cort one little bit of credit, and that is he's coming at this from the point of view of a zealot. He's coming at it from one of the cult members' point of view, right? He actually believes this stuff. He buys into the whole marijuana addiction thing because his life sucked. He was having some terrible problems. He was a marijuana smoker, and therefore it must have been marijuana's fault. But he is one of the few board members of Project Sam who isn't financially benefiting from the status quo of prohibition. I mean, consider Kevin Sabet, who converts state and federal anti-drug education money into a $3,000 per appearance tour, all expenses paid. Or consider like more than half of the board of Project Sam, who are fighting to keep drug court mandated marijuana consumers flowing into the drug rehabs they own or operate. People like Ben Cort, who in the book says he was forced into, quote, court-ordered meetings, lots of them, end quote. So he figures, you know, he had problems with weed, he got busted, he got caught, they forced him into rehab, he liked it, so that should be the way it goes for the rest of us. Now, a quick glance at the bullet points on the back cover for the book shows that it contains all the typical bullshit you'd find in these sort of prohibitionist books. He says, there are more marijuana dispensaries in Starbucks, more marijuana dispensaries in Denver than Starbucks and McDonald's combined. It'd be nice if they had a marijuana dispensary in a Starbucks, wouldn't it? There are more dispensaries in Denver than Starbucks and marijuana combined. Okay, sure. But are there more places where you can buy a cup of coffee and a hamburger in Denver than places you can buy weed? And for bonus points, how many people died from caffeine overdoses? 20,000 ER visits every year, folks. And how many people died from obesity? $147 billion in medical costs every year, folks. Compared to the deaths from marijuana? Zero? That's right. So what if there's more dispensaries than Starbucks or McDonald's? The stuff the dispensaries are selling won't kill you. He also has a bullet point here. You'd have to smoke 15 joints in 1970 to get the same high as just one joint today. Oh, so I guess Ben Cort's telling us that today's marijuana is just 1/15th as much of a respiratory hazard as the 1970s weed. Right? Or he's telling us that the weed from the 1970s, which we were told at the time would cause heroin addiction, chromosomal damage, and man boobs, wasn't really that bad, was it? He also says, in 1996, the average THC was 5% or less. Today, 30% is the norm. Yeah. In the 90s, they were smoking 5% THC weed. Sure. Sure. I suppose Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre were smoking an ounce of ditch weed along with sipping their gin and juice. Sure. And really, what difference does the average potency make when, as Court mentioned in the previous point, we tokers are working toward, quote, the same high, end quote. He said you'd have to smoke 15 joints in 1970 to get the same high as a joint today. So what you're telling us is THC gets you high. How potent it does doesn't change what the high is. One of his bullet points says, indoor marijuana growing accounts for 1% of the total electricity use in the U.S., producing greenhouse gas emissions equal to that of 3 million cars. Oh, geez, I guess we ought to change the prohibitionist policies that are forcing cannabis growers to not grow their crops under free sunshine, wind, and rain then, right? What else we got here? Oh, pesticides levels, 6 times the maximum allowed by the federal government, have been found on plants quarantined at marijuana grow houses in Denver. Wait, so weed laden with poisons that an unlicensed grower would have just sold to unsuspecting customers on the underground market was instead caught and quarantined by a regulated system that includes inspections and testing? And this is bad somehow. Okay. And the final bullet point, the black market has not disappeared. In fact, it has only grown since legalization. Well, that seems mathematically unlikely. Consider that Colorado has sold over $1 billion in marijuana. So before it was legal, at least $1 billion was being sold on the black market. So if we took $1 billion worth of product out of the illicit market, the illegal dealers would have to make up more than $1 billion in sales for them to be bigger than they were before. Now, while this book has all the typical long debunked dreck, it does contain one thing I have never seen in a prohibitionist book before. Me. I'm in this book in a chapter called The Lobby, Where the Gold's At. Court recalls the debate I had with him at Texas Christian University in 2015. He describes me as the host of a, quote, 24-hour legalization talk show, end quote, which surprised me as I didn't know I was broadcasting in my sleep. He also described Marijuana Policy Project's SUV, quote, wrapped and covered with weed plants and their logo, end quote, which will surprise both MPP and the actual van's owners, DFW Normal. I know, such an easy mistake to make, right? MPP Normal. MPP's logo is round and blue. Normal's is long and green. But here's a guy that says that it was covered with weed plants when, in fact, the DFW Normal SUV has one pot leaf on the door, and one pot leaf on the hood, and one pot leaf on the back. The rest of it's just all white, right? He's making it sound as if it was like completely vinyl wrapped with weed. But the point that Court tries to make here, the overarching point he makes in including me in this book, is to try to paint this picture where he's the, oh, I'm just the kind, considerate fellow who wants an honest, forthright conversation, only to be met by me and, quote, several young men who did their best to make me feel uncomfortable by surrounding me and standing inside my personal space, end quote. See, the point, he's trying to make it seem like we, those of us in the legalization side, are just this rude, obnoxious, uncaring, heartless, profit-seeking bastards, right? Now, as far as the several young men, those were some of my friends from DFW Normal. And they weren't like standing inside my personal space makes it sound like they were like right face to face with the guy, you know, crowding in on him. They were in a small circle around the two of us. They were no closer to him than they were to me. And it was more like how, you know, they, it was basically just some of them doing their best to try to observe me and Ben meeting each other. You know, the same way some fans might surround a critic who's meeting a celebrity that they like. Of course, I can understand how someone who's unused to being popular could be intimidated by that. Anyway, Court laments this debate format that we had because, quote, people were less interested in data and more interested in zingers, end quote, which is a charitable way of saying I kicked his ass in the debate, judging by the audience reaction. But then he turns to a Facebook post of mine that I'd written prior to the debate, where I described him as someone who, quote, supports testing my piss to determine my character, using cops to enforce sobriety, and incarceration of minorities at disproportionate rates. That's my quote. His response to that was, quote, I'm not sure what the testing my piss thing was all about, end quote, as he continues to paint this picture of me as the uncaring, rude pot lobby shill. Oh, and by the way, Ben, the whole testing my piss thing, I was talking about this part of your group's agenda that says, quote, the possession of or use of a small amount of marijuana should be a civil offense subject to a mandatory health screening. You suppose they might take some piss there? And marijuana education program as appropriate, referrals to treatment, you know, where they take your piss, and or social services should be made if needed. The individual could even be monitored for 6 to 12 months in a probation program designed to prevent further drug use, end quote. Who wants to bet that involves some piss testing? Finally, to complete the character assassination, he recalls the part of the debate where he was whining about being a person in recovery from marijuana who has to be assaulted by the smell of weed wherever he goes. I responded to him by saying, as a guy in recovery from obesity, I hate it when I have to smell the donut shop by my house. And that's when Ben Court leaps to try to make it seem as if I'm a terrible, heartless, cruel bastard. He writes, quote, my first reaction to him saying he was a food addict was compassion. Eating disorders are a huge and growing problem in our society, and I have plenty of friends who have struggled with them. They are actually more lethal in many cases than chemical addiction. My sympathy disappeared pretty quickly when I realized he was making fun of the daily fight I and others have to stay sober and was taking a shot at people who really do struggle with food-related addictions. The point I made was that nobody cares about responsible adults who want to get high. End quote. Well, never mind that I wasn't making fun of anybody's struggle with addiction. My father nearly died from alcoholism. My aunt and my grandmother died from diabetes related to obesity. I myself have overcome dependence on alcohol and methamphetamines that put me in the emergency room for life-saving surgery. You know, real addictions that can kill you. Unlike marijuana. So what Court is doing here, and probably purposely, is failing to account for the fact that nobody is calling for donut shops to be shut down because of the offending smell. Nobody is arresting or ticketing people who like donuts. Nobody is testing the blood sugar of donut eaters to determine their fitness for employment. Nobody is forcing people caught with donuts to submit to court-ordered Weight Watchers and mandatory CrossFit. Nobody is calling for Krispy Kreme CEOs to be imprisoned and their market turned over to thousands of home-based criminal donut labs. But all these little lies pale in comparison to that last lie he told. He even says it in his introduction, quote, I am not concerned with casual adult marijuana use. So long as kids don't see you and you're not driving, I seriously don't care if an adult chooses to consume weed. Bullshit. Yes, you do care. You care a whole lot whether this adult chooses to casually consume weed. In 2014, here in the state of Oregon, we were fighting for the legalization of marijuana. And during a televised debate, now Kevin or Ben wasn't at this one, but I was in the audience and I asked the question, and I'll just basically paraphrase, I don't have a car, at least at the time I didn't have a car. I don't have a car. I don't drive. I use public transportation everywhere I go. I don't have any children, and I work from home. There's no way my pot use affects the kids, affects the roadways, or affects anybody but me. And yet, they would have had our Measure 91 go down in defeat and forced me to continue to deal with a criminal market to get my weed that they say they don't care whether I use. All this Project Samuel talk about fighting commercialization is a lie. It's a lie. It's designed to deflect charges of being reefer mad prohibitionists. It's a lie so they can say, oh, no, no, we're not for lock everybody up. No, no, no. We're for the third way, the sensible middle. I mean, in that same 2014 Oregon tour, when Kevin Sabet toured my state making $3,000 of taxpayer money put in his pocket for every appearance, including being paid for his expenses, his flights, his hotels, his meals, taxpayer money. While he was going around Oregon, I followed him. I followed him around Oregon, and I asked him, what about Washington, D.C.? In 2014, Washington, D.C. proposed legalizing personal use and cultivation with no commercial market, right? No big marijuana 2.0, new big tobacco 2.0, no big marijuana lobby, no commercial sales of marijuana. It was exactly what Ben Court says he doesn't care about. Casual adult marijuana use. So did Kevin Sabet support Washington, D.C.'s legalization? Hell no. Hell no. He said he opposed it because while Initiative 71 didn't have any commercial aspects in it, the D.C. City Council, after it passed, was then going to try to add a commercial aspect. So I guess Project Samuel's okay with casual adult marijuana use, but only if nobody ever buys or sells it now or in the future. And that's the Achilles heel of all this reefer madness bleeding from Ben Court, Kevin Sabet, and all the others. The Achilles heel, the marijuana market. In order to engage in this casual adult marijuana use they don't care about, I have to have some marijuana. It doesn't just magically appear in my bowl through wishing. Wouldn't that be cool? Somebody has to grow that cannabis. Somebody has to process that cannabis. Somebody has to sell its marijuana to me. And Project Samuel says those acts should, quote, remain misdemeanors or felonies based on amounts possessed, end quote. The people who grow and sell cannabis should be subject to, quote, assessment and mandatory treatment in prison, end quote. Ben Court is telling you he doesn't care about your casual adult marijuana use. Right there on page one, he doesn't care about your casual adult marijuana use. But then on page 121, he says, quote, your drug use at any level makes cartels stronger. Followed by page 127, quote, consider that the drugs you are doing really do harm to someone other than yourself and loved ones. They contribute to violent cartels hell-bent on making quick and easy money any way they can, end quote. How can Ben Court claim he doesn't care about casual adult marijuana use while at the same time explaining how that adult use, absent a legal market, empowers violent cartels? I mean, it's remarkable. You look in this, there is just so packed with lies and flat out fabrications. He points out any law enforcement people, any cops that you hear saying legalization not to be a good idea are speakers from law enforcement against prohibition who are well paid to say those things. Flat out lie, Ben. No LEAP speaker is paid. Flat out lies in this book. And I'm calling you out on him. I'm calling you out on him. Ben actually makes a point in here. It's remarkable. He makes a point in here about the Mexican cartels. And he says how the Mexican cartels, they only get like 7 to 20% of their money from marijuana. And they're going to get their money, you know, if you make marijuana illegal, they're not going to suddenly go get jobs at Starbucks or McDonald's. They're going to find other criminal ways to make money. Well, no shit. They're criminals. That's what they do. It's in the job title. The question is, why do you want criminals, people who have no problem with kidnapping and murdering and maiming people, why do you want them to control the marijuana market? This is their Achilles heel. They want to pretend that you could make the marijuana market go away by having people just say no. Seriously, in this book, he talks about America needs to stop getting so high. Wouldn't it be great if we managed to get people to stop consuming substances? Sure, it would be great. Yeah, it'd be great, too, if everybody exercised. It'd be great, too, if everybody ate a vegetarian diet. It'd be great. But it ain't going to happen. These people don't live in the real world. He makes this point about the Mexican cartels. It just blows my mind, where he says that since marijuana legalization, the Mexican cartels can't make any money on marijuana anymore, so they're switching to heroin, and more heroin is a bad thing. So I guess his point is that we need to keep marijuana illegal so that we can give the violent criminals something safer to sell. That's what that boils down to, doesn't it? It boils down to prohibition is a make-work program for violent cartels to sell safer drugs. That's his policy. That's what he's supporting. This is insane. This is just, this whole book is just pure insanity. I haven't even begun to go through and highlight all of this, but it's really amazing, folks. He's got a chapter in here in concentrates and vaping and edibles, medical marijuana. And he also makes that insane point. I love this one. He says, he makes the point against marijuana is safer than alcohol. And the way he responds to that is, well, wouldn't jumping out the 7th floor of a building be safer than jumping out the 8th floor of a building? Wouldn't being hit by a car at 30 miles an hour be safer than being hit by a car at 50 miles an hour? That's the way these people really think. Can you believe this? Saying that marijuana is safer than alcohol isn't saying it's a 7th floor jump compared to an 8th floor jump. We're saying it's walking on the sidewalk compared to an 8th floor jump. Jesus. It's not being hit by a car at 30 versus 50. It's being not hit by a car versus being hit by a car. Ben, you can't make these analogies to things where both A and B kill you. Because with alcohol and marijuana, A kills you and B does not. It's just remarkable. I mean, I swear I could just take Kevin Sabet's book, Ben Cort's book, and Dr. Stuart Gitlow's book, three Project Sam guys. I could just take their books and just start writing the debunks of them, and I swear I'd have my own book. In fact, I think that's probably what I'll do. I encourage you to check it out, Weed Inc. You need some hilarious reading. But folks, that's all the time we got for today. Got things to do. For everyone here at Delta 9 House and Studios, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and news you can use for the cannabis community. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
You say you're free, you plan it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seat, you plan it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it.